Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Monday morning, which means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And every Monday morning, my dad calls in and tells a joke. We also have the Monday morning movie reviews, which we're about to jump into. We are also going to talk about some of the best movie endings of all time and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. For talk and text, 312-981-7200. Monday morning movie reviews. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every week to talk about the movie reviews, and then we'll talk about the box office as well. So let's get the guys in. Steve, welcome back.
Good morning.
And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Let's get into it. So, Steve, tell us about the Jay and Silent Bob reboot.
Ah, yes, the long-awaited. Written and directed by none other than Kevin Smith, Jay and Silent Bob reboot stars Smith and Jason Mewes, coming back as the sex-starved stoners that we met 25 years ago in Clerks. And we've seen them throughout the years in supporting roles and starring roles in Mallrats and Chasing Amy, Dogma, Clerks 2, and most relevant to this film, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. This is sort of a direct follow-up to that, although it's like 13 years later. In that movie, they went on a road trip to Hollywood to stop a movie from being made about characters based on them, Blunt Man and Chronic. And now someone is trying to reboot the characters in a new version of Blunt Man and Chronic. And so they hit the road once again to rehash old jokes and visit old friends and stop another movie from being made. This one directed by, ironically, Kevin Smith. So, having survived a heart attack since his last film, Smith has definitely sort of different themes in mind this time, and including very strong feelings about family. He casts his daughter again, Harley Quinn Smith, as Jay's love child with Shannon Elizabeth's character from Strike Back. He never knew he had a love child until this movie, but she does end up accompanying them on their journey to Hollywood because she and a friend want to attend a Blunt Man and Chronic convention known as Chronicon that is going on, and hopefully win a role or a walk-on role in the new Blunt Man and Chronic movie. As I mentioned, we revisit some old pals, including Matt Damon, who is sort of in an unexpected role, and Jason Lee, Jason Biggs, James Vanderbeek, Rosario Dawson, some new friends like Chris Hemsworth and Kate Micucci, and so many others. The jokes kind of fly fast and furious. Some of them land, some of them connect like a wet fart in the wind, and most of them have to do with how this film is deliberately trying to lift elements of Strike Back so blatantly that we're supposed to think it's by design instead of just because it was an easy way to go. The movie is in theory supposed to be making fun of reboots, but I think maybe not on purpose every time falls into some of those pitfalls that a lot of reboots do. The Chronicon stuff is actually takes the story in a new direction away from the Strike Back storyline, and so some of that stuff actually is a little bit funnier and a little bit better, and it includes a really nice extended monologue by Ben Affleck, who Smith had a falling out with a while back, and they sort of patched things up just in time to make this movie. It deals with sort of the hazards and joys of getting older and growing up and taking on the responsibility of being a parent. And he also manages to slip in a few pretty funny Batman jokes. Look, I mean, Kevin Smith has his diehard fans without a doubt, and I have no doubt they're going to love eat up every minute of this thing. There are some cameos I haven't even mentioned, and some of them are pretty inspired. Some of them are so in-jokey that to the view askew universe that I think like 10 people in the whole world are even going to get them. I wouldn't say I loved it, but it certainly amused me to a certain degree. I will say that Kevin Smith playing himself might be one of the more taxing experiences I've ever had in one of his movies. And I think I'm more looking forward to the Clerks 3 movie that he said he's making now, because I like the Clerks movies more than the Jay and Silent Bob film. So, but it is interesting to see Smith sort of showing signs of maturing in his filmmaking. I'm not necessarily sure that's a good thing for his comedies. But, you know, I have sort of enjoyed some of the more serious things he's done over the years, so maybe we'll see some of that down the line. But this feels like a little bit of a step back. It feels like an easy path to travel for him. But, you know, at the same time, there's two sold-out shows of this thing at the Music Box tomorrow because Smith and Muse are going to be there, so... You know, what the hell do I know? It's certainly not his best or funniest effort, but I hate to use the phrase fan service, but that's kind of what it feels like. So,
yeah. Well, I haven't seen it, but I mean, that's what it feels like to me, and I haven't even seen it.
I don't know where all it's open. It's actually is playing Midnights at the Music Box next weekend, so you will have a chance to see it, and at some point, I don't know if it's opening in other theaters. I'm not sure what the path is here, but. Yeah, I mean, if you want to see it already, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think you can figure that out. I think that goes without saying. Okay, that's Jay and Silent Bob reboot. All right. Eric, tell us about Zombieland 2 Double Tap.
Well, speaking of sequels that come a decade later, this is the sequel to the enormously enjoyable and quite successful Zombieland from 2009. Ruben Fleischer, the film's original director, is back, and he's brought back the original cast, Woody Harrelson, Jesse Eisenberg, Emma Stone, and Abigail Breslin. And it's set 10 years after the previous movie. The gang is the sort of makeshift family is still together fighting zombies, zombies that have evolved a bit over time, taking sort of a cue from the George Romero days. That there are different types of zombies now. Some have gotten dumber, some have actually gained in power and strength, and they're holed up at the beginning of the movie in the White House, because why not, I guess, and, you know, doing about their normal routines. Then they meet some new people along the way, because Abigail Breslin's character wants to basically, you know, explore a bit more. Sort of, you know, she's I think past her teenage years now, and actually wants to hang out with people her own age. She ends up on a road trip with a sort of a stoner hippie named Berkeley, and the gang. You know, it's not set to hold up at the White House forever. Want to go find her, and that puts them out on a journey, and they meet a really ditzy blonde played by Zoe Deutsch, as well as taking a cue from Shaun of the Dead and meeting some doppelgangers along the way played by Luke Wilson and Thomas Middleditch. So there's the basic plot for the sequel 10
okay.
years later.
All right, hang on. Mm-hmm. Eric, hang on. We'll take a quick break here. And Steve and Eric, you guys hang on, and we'll come back, and we'll find out what Eric thought of Zombieland Double Tap and what we thought of it and all everybody else. So that's all coming up right here on 720 WGN, and we shall return right after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and we're here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. It's Monday. That's why it's jokey time. And we also have the Monday morning movie reviews that we are doing right now. We're going to talk about best movie endings of all time, and we'll tackle the box office as well. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. All right, let's get the guys back on. Here's Steve. Welcome back.
Hello.
And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, you were telling us about Zombieland Double Tap.
Yeah, and, you know, go back 10 years when we reviewed the original on the show. I still remember walking out of that screening for Zombieland, really on, you know, a bit of a high. Just, you know, it was 80-some minutes of just pure joy, really funny, really sort of original take on the zombie genre. Really before we have sort of been inundated with zombie film after zombie film, this was still in a period where a movie like this could still be considered a bit fresh and original. And I remember I said to someone walking out of that screening that I would watch a sequel to this movie right now. And they made me wait 10 years for it. And, you know, as much as I enjoyed that original film, you know, I've sort of cooled on the idea of needing a sequel. And I think this film gets off to a bit of a rough start. Like a lot of sequels, it feels like, you know, this is kind of a criticism for the entire movie, that it feels like it needs to repeat the jokes and things that, speaking of fan service, that fans of the original really like. So it's a safe way, it's a safe road to travel down, to give everyone the exact same stuff. Hey, remember this? We're going to do this joke again, and you laugh, so please laugh again. And the first 15, 20 minutes or so, as they're sort of settled at the White House, which really, they kind of missed the opportunity to really go for some really pointed jokes. You know, they did that for a reason and didn't really quite take advantage of it. They sort of, the characters themselves, the way that they interact, it's almost like they reset the characters to the beginning of Zombieland when they first met. And they haven't, after 10 years, have evolved the way they did at the end of the first movie into this sort of this makeshift family, that two people fell in love. One of them was sort of this weird father figure to all of them. And there's this mutual respect and, you know, even love between these characters. And here they're just, you know, doing the same old shtick. They're all just kind of getting on their nerves. And, you know, Jesse Eisenberg's doing the awkward thing. Emma Stone's doing the distant thing. Abigail Breslin wants to, you know, be tougher than she actually is. And Woody Harrelson is just being kind of a jerk to everyone. But then a wonderful thing happens along the way. And her name is Zoe Deutsch. And she enters this movie, and I don't think there's a moment she's on screen where she does something where I didn't smile, laugh out loud, or laugh out loud hysterically. I think every time she winked in this movie, I laughed heartily. And the way that, you know, I don't want to spoil too much, but the way they kind of weave her, you know, back into the story and stuff, I wish there was more of her. But everything she does is a pure delight. I did like, as much as when I first saw the trailer and saw that they're basically doing the Shaun of the Dead joke with Luke Wilson and Thomas Middleditch, I actually enjoyed their section of the film. I thought that there were some laughs to be had there, particularly the Middleditch and Eisenberg playing off each other, I thought was really fun. So I liked, you know, bits and stuff like that. And then it kind of leads to, you know, a similar type finale where everyone's holed up and all the zombies are going to attack and whatnot, but not quite as creative as the amusement park finale of the original one. So to me, the whole thing is kind of a mixed bag. I'm not entirely down on it. The more I sort of thought about it, sort of measuring just how much fun I had with the original compared to what I had with this one, I'm really just kind of on the fence about the whole thing, but I would absolutely recommend it to anyone who wants to experience what Zoe Deutsch brings to this movie, because it is so great that I would recommend it purely on her performance alone. But, you know, for people who really love the original, I would say, you know, maybe wait until it's on cable and it'll be a nice distraction. I wouldn't exactly pay full price for it. It's just kind of okay.
All right. Steve, what do you think?
I liked it more than Eric, but he's absolutely right. The retread stuff is just there. It's sort of there. I think, and it's a little bit necessary because it has been 10 years, and we have to remember this. The first film came out before the Walking Dead TV show, so we weren't quite as inundated with zombies as we are now. But we had to kind of remind us what the rules are again in this particular zombie world. So, but he's right. That stuff is less interesting than the new stuff, the new characters. Zoe Deutsch is very funny. The dumb blonde jokes don't always land, but Deutsch sort of hints that there's a little something more knowing going on behind those vacant eyes, so I liked her a great deal. He didn't even mention my personal favorite new character is one called Nevada, played by Rosario Dawson, who owns an Elvis museum, which immediately endears her to Woody Harrelson's character, and I love the interaction that they have. I love when they bring in the two doppelganger characters. There's a fight sequence in the museum that kind of levels the museum. It looks like it's done in one take, and it's phenomenal. It's like the best action scene in the whole film. But the bottom line is, you know, like I laughed a lot during Double Tap. And you know, like I said, the zombie stuff and the apocalypse and all that isn't really the point of this. It was more about the interactions that these four people have when somebody else tries to sort of infiltrate their group. And I think Dawson adds a tremendous amount to it. And she's a really great counterpoint to Woody Harrelson's sort of bravado. Which honestly, like Woody Harrelson's character and his outlook on life feels a little dated 10 years later, and probably needs a little updating. But it's sort of fun to watch him take down woke culture in a certain way. We should also mention you definitely should stick around through the very end of the credits if you want a reminder of one of the best elements of the first film. I'm going to make sure nobody leaves before that. So sequels don't always give us new and improved, and more often they're about being cinematic comfort food. And I found this meal largely satisfying. So
I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. I love the first movie, and this was just kind of more of the same. But as you said, Eric, Zoe Deutsch steals this thing. She owns the movie. I mean, it's all her. I like this cast. I like the camaraderie between them and what happens between them. They really work well together. But man, she just comes in. Zoe Deutsch just comes in, like, and just steals it. So if you like the first movie, you're just basically getting more of what you got in the first movie, and it just took them 10 years to put it together, which is just strange to me, but it works, you know. Rosario Dawson again, as you mentioned, Steve, she's great. She's a terrific addition to the cast. She's really good in it. The doppelganger stuff is very funny. It is what it is. If you like the first Zombieland, you're going to get more of this, more of it. And there's some really great stuff in it. And again, yes, stay for everything, the full credits, afterwards and all of that stuff. Cause you get, it's a nice payoff. But again, as much fun as this movie is, I gotta say, man, Zoe Deutsch, man, she's so hilarious. She's just great. So,
and I will say that if you stay through the end credits, you will see a better short movie than the entirety of The Dead Don't Die.
Right. Okay. We'll agree to disagree on that one. All right. You guys hang on a second, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress here. We got more movies to review, and we'll do that when we get back right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We are live on a Monday morning here. My dad is going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning. We're going to talk about the best movie endings of all time and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every Monday morning to review the movies. Let's get the guys back. Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Steve, you're the only one that went to see the old Maleficent.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so why don't you tell us all about it?
Oh, boy. Okay, well, I honestly, I know we were talking about how it's been 10 years since Zombieland, but I can't actually believe it's been 5 years since the first Maleficent. It doesn't seem that long ago, but it's been 5 years and since Maleficent came into our lives and just absolutely set the record straight on just how the Sleeping Beauty legend really played out, thus giving Disney the excuse to cast Angelina Jolie as a slinky sorceress or whatever the hell Maleficent's supposed to be. But now we've made our way through this alternative look at this beloved story, and now we get Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, that brings us an entirely new story of warring kingdoms and a wedding and an unexpected enemy that isn't really that unexpected, and the young Aurora, played by Elle Fanning, sort of caught between the worlds of humans and that of the fairies, which is run by her loving godmother, who just happens to be also the realm's most feared entity. So a few points to start with. Mistress of Evil is a beautiful looking movie, and I'm sure it costs a small fortune, but every penny is definitely up there on the screen. And even when I was usually bored by the subpar textbook fantasy storyline, the visuals kept me engaged to a certain degree. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what I was looking at when these little three fairy sisters played by Juno Temple, Imelda Staunton, and Leslie Manville show up. I'm not sure what they're supposed to be or how they did that, but I was mesmerized by it. They were in the first film, too. But there's also dozens of other sort of woodland creatures that are really a treat for the eyes and like I said, kept me mildly interested. And even more so than the first film, Maleficent is just downright sexy, a point made abundantly clear by Jolie as she sort of cycles through more costume changes than Cher in Vegas. And and there are like, and these aren't like button-up dignified outfits. There's like skin showing. There's someone went shopping in like the sexy Maleficent costume aisle at the pop-up Halloween store. And I'm in no way complaining, but man, parents need to be aware that their children, male or female, might actually go through puberty during this movie. The plot of Mistress of Evil feels arbitrary. Prince Philip is now played by a different actor. Harris Dickinson has decided he wants to marry Aurora. Maleficent is against it. His parents are willing to give it a try, and they invite Aurora and Maleficent over for dinner. His parents are played by Michelle Pfeiffer and Robert Lindsay, and of course, this dinner explodes into a huge scuffle, and something happens, and the king lapses into a coma, and the queen blames Maleficent for his condition. So it forces Maleficent to flee the entire country, and she's wounded and left for dead. But she's discovered by a winged, horned creature just like herself, who's played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, and she quickly learns that there's an entire civilization of creatures like her that's been hidden from human view for hundreds of years, and all roads kind of lead to this massive battle between these two worlds, fueled by misinformation spread by Michelle Pfeiffer's character about a threat that these sort of fantastical creatures pose to humans. She happens to have a hidden lab under her castle that is devoted to basically creating chemical weapons that are only deadly to these fairy creatures, and she wants them all dead. Yes, this is actually a PG-rated children's film about genocide. I will make that very clear. The film is directed by Joaquin Roning, who did the Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man Tell No Tales. Was that the last one, or was there one after that? I can't even remember.
I have no idea.
Yeah. But anyway, he did one of them, and one of the, well, yeah, anyway. So But I think the film's greatest crime is that it gets so lost in the fantasy elements that it forgets to create engaging characters or a story that generates any real drama. And if you can't make if you can't squeeze drama out of a genocidal tale, there's a real issue there. So, but considering how little I remember about the first film, I do recall that one of its strengths was that Jolie and Fanning had a real interesting dynamic, most of which is totally ignored in this film because they're hardly ever on screen together. That being said, Mistress of Evil is the better of the two films, I will say that, for what that's worth. And again, based largely on the creativity and the artistry on display and less about the very basics of good storytelling. I don't usually recommend a film just based on its spectacle value. I'm probably closer on this than I would be with another film, but take that for what it's worth, but I still am not recommending it.
Okay. All right. There you go. Maleficent. And we'll talk about the box office that it did a little bit later on. All right, Eric.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about let's talk about Parasite.
All right.
Let's not talk too much about it, though.
Right.
As we know.
Yes, I was going to preface this by saying that, you know, we did talk about this a little bit from Toronto, and the people who are listening now are going to know a little bit more about the movie than even I did going in, because I literally went into the screening knowing nothing about it that other than it was directed by Bong Joon-ho, and that was enough, clearly. What the people want to know what the basis of the film is about, it is about a family of four living in Korea, sort of a, you know, basically a low-income kind of freeloader type family. They're the kind of type of family that steals Wi-Fi from next apartment. They look for you know free food wherever they possibly can. The mom and dad and the two teenage son and daughter. The son has a friend who is tutoring a young girl in a wealthier family, at least. And he is going to go away, and he asks the teenage son of the family if he will basically take over, pretend to be a tutor. And that way, you can sort of keep, his standing, and make a little couple of bucks for the family. So the son basically pretends to be a tutor. He ingratiates himself into the family, and sooner than later, he starts bringing more people from his family into the relationship with this family. And that's really about all you really want to know going into this movie.
Yeah.
So we'll leave the plot right there.
Okay. Well, you guys hang on, okay?
Uh-huh.
All right. We'll talk more about Parasite. We're going to take a break here. We don't want to give too much away. This is one of those movies that the less you know about it, the more effective it's going to be. But we've got a lot to talk about with this movie. It's called Parasite, and Steve and Eric and I will review it right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on 720 WGN. Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're here till 5 a.m. The opening bell is at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And it's Monday morning movie reviews. We're going to do the box office as well. Let's welcome Steve and Eric back. Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Eric. We talked a little bit about the plot for this movie called Parasite.
Yes.
All right, well, what did you think?
Well, I certainly don't want to bury the lead for everyone here, but this is absolutely one of the best movies of the year. I think I said when we talked about this at Toronto that I'm always really fascinated with movies that tackle elements and issues between the classes, particularly the upper and lower classes. I think that's a minefield of really interesting things that you can talk about there. In fact, just before we on the air tonight, I was actually just rewatching David Mamet's The Spanish Prisoner, which I think is kind of a underappreciated movie about class structure. It's a movie that kind of gets that element of it kind of gets lost given the sort of Hitchcockian labyrinth of plot that that movie puts you through. But in some ways, I think it's kind of an apt comparison to Parasite in a way, because this movie certainly puts you through a number of twists and turns as well, to the point that even though the class stuff is very much at the forefront, it's very easy, you just get overwhelmed sometimes by the ride that you're being put on. But, you know, make no mistake, this is absolutely a movie about the classes. And Bong Joon-ho has done some remarkable movies about that very subject. Most people have, you know, have probably seen Snowpiercer, which you don't get much more obvious and blatant in taking a genre picture that is all about, you know, the poor live in the back car and the rich live in the front car. That's, you know, that's exactly how our society is structured. And, you know, seeing, you know, this is a movie where, you know, the lower class family, in many ways, are sort of our heroes in a way. But you know, even though we watch them doing some very, you know, horrible things at times, there's deception and lying and things. Not that, you know, we're going to feel too sorry for the rich people who are so aloof that they cannot even be bothered to do background checks on who these people coming into their homes are, as long as they're treating their, you know, their kids well and they're advancing their standings in the world. But you know, this is a movie where, you know, you can actually, you know, ascribe blame to both sides of these people, and you know where it eventually takes us in such crazy ways. Again, you don't even want to hint at some of the directions that this movie takes you to, because it's just going to shock and surprise. And yet, many times, this is an incredibly funny movie. You know, there's slapstick humor in here, even when it gets a little bit horrific at times, and leads us up to an ending that, well, again, you don't want to say too much about it. But this is a movie that is going to linger with people who see it. It's clearly doing incredible business in limited release right now in the box office. And when people see this movie, they'll be forced to talk about it. They'll be forced to talk about what they've just seen and what they think it all is supposed to mean and who exactly they're siding with when they come out of the theater. But yeah, this is absolutely one of the best films of the year, and it demands to be seen, particularly if you can see it with an audience who knows about it as little about it as you do.
Yeah. All right, Steve, what do you think?
I think it's a candidate for the best movie of the year, as far as I'm concerned. What's really fascinating about it, I mean, at least especially in the first half, is that the way that the two families are portrayed, the poor family is not presented as bad people. They are con artists of a sort. They're master manipulators, but all they're really doing is trying to all be employed and make money and like get out of these sort of dregs that they live in. They're not doing anything bad once they get into these positions in this household. And the rich family is not portrayed as bad or, you know, like, or anything like that. They're actually, they seem like a pretty nice family. And it's interesting that the title of the film gives maybe more away than anything that, you know, who is the parasite and who is the host. And you kind of think you know for a while. And then there are elements introduced much later that sort of change the whole dynamic. But, like, and Eric said, it's like a smart, sharp send up of classism, of consumerism. And it kind of says to us that if the rich aren't going to share with those less fortunate might just take them, take what they need. And I'm sure that's an idea that is very scary and alarming to a certain segment of the population. And yeah, I mean, and on top of that, like the art direction, the cinematography are all beyond impressive. And obviously the cast is flawless. And look, this is the winner of the Palme d'Or at Cannes. It's South Korea's submission for best, whatever the new category is called, international feature Oscar at the Academy Awards. Like I said, it might be the best film of the year. And if you somehow still manage to not see it, and you have access to it, something's horribly wrong with you. Don't be afraid of subtitles. Just go. This guy, like he mentioned Snowpiercer, but he also made The Host and Mother and Okja, which I didn't even like that much, but it's still pretty good. So there's really no reason not to see this thing. And I can't wait. It's like the film I can't wait to see again the most right now. So.
Yeah, I agree with you. I can't wait to see it again. It's one of the best movies of the year, if not the best film I've seen all year. It's hard to talk about without giving anything away, because I don't want to give anything away, but I want people to see this movie. It is amazing. Everything about it, it's so beautifully directed and so surprising, at every turn. You have no idea where this thing is going and again, what it's saying about classism and what it's saying about, these families is pretty remarkable. But, this is as strong a movie as I've seen all year, and I was just blown away by it. I just, as soon as it was over, I was just like, okay, I wanted to sit through it one more time. It's great. It's a great movie. Now, it's only playing in, like, four theaters. It's playing in Evanston. It's playing at the Landmark, at the Arclight, and at the, where I saw it, which is the AMC River East downtown. Mm-hmm. Is it going to open, Eric, is it going to open wider, you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the businesses that this movie is doing right now is, you know, up there with the movies that you would expect, the movies that end up being Oscar players and stuff like that. That's the kind of money it's making right now in 33 theaters this week. Neon, I don't know how fast they're going to do it. They might try to extend this thing as far as they possibly can through award season.
Yeah.
But they should really start methodically getting this into a few hundred more theaters next week and maybe another 500 theaters in the week after that, because the iron is hot right now and Neon needs to strike.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think this is going to be. This is going to be sticking around for a long time. I think once people start to see it, more people start to see it, the word is going to spread, and it's going to be around for the rest of the year at least. And it's obviously going to be mentioned at the end of the year when people are putting their lists together and when the awards situations arise. This thing is going to be. This is going to be talked about for the rest of the year.
I'm curious, Eric, if you think this actually has a possibility of like a flat out Best Picture nomination.
I think it does. I mean,
yeah,
I agree. Yeah. I wouldn't bet on it right now, but I wouldn't bet on most movies right now being Best Picture because we still got 2 months of movies to go.
Right.
But I think that this, for a while there, I think, The Farewell had an opportunity to get in the Best Picture, and, I don't know if they're going to nominate two foreign language films. I'd be obviously fine with that.
Yeah.
But I think that, if they're going to do it, Parasite might be the one that now takes over that spot.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, it's a great film. that's all there is to it. It's a great film. All right. Next week, what do we got? We got The Lighthouse. We got Jojo Rabbit, right?
Yeah.
The Current War Returns.
The Current War. Okay.
The Current War Director's Cut.
Yeah. We were all waiting for that.
Yes, exactly.
And actually, that Bruce Springsteen movie, Western Stars, is coming out next week, too.
Okay, all right.
Western Stars, Black and Blue with Naomi Harris,
right.
Top thriller, and some horror movie from Blumhouse called Countdown.
Right. I saw the trailer for it. Well, yeah. Oh, boy. Uh-huh.
They are burying the hell out of that one.
Yes, they are. All right. Mm-hmm. Steve, we'll talk to you next week, okay, buddy?
Yes.
Thanks,
yes.
Man.
Take care.
All right. And Eric, you hang on, okay? All right, Eric's going to hang on. When we come back, we'll take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll go box office right here on 720 WGN.
Girls.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We are on 720 WGN, and it is Monday morning, which means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We are also going to talk about the best movie endings of all time. And we've just reviewed the new movies, talking about what we're going to see next week. But Eric Childress is with us. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Eric writes about the box office every week. Was this this weekend average, or what did the movies make more money than you thought they would?
Well, it did. I mean, overall, it did for an October weekend. It was very good. I mean, the top four films, I think, grossed $100 million just by themselves. So that's very good. Individually, though, you know, like starting at the movie at the top, though, whether or not they're actually going to turn a profit is another story.
Mm. Okay. All right, well, let's talk about it. Number one is Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, $36 million. How is that compared to the first one?
Not good. Not good at all. I mean, it might surprise you, but the original Maleficent actually opened to $69 million back in 2014. Yeah, that was a summer release by Disney at the end of May after Memorial Day. $69 million, grossed over $240 million in the U.S., grossed over $758 million worldwide.
Wow.
Yeah.
I just don't remember it being impactful at all. I really don't remember much of it at all.
Yeah, I don't think people remember the movie itself, but at that time, it was just making money hand over fist. I think it surprised probably surprised Disney how much money that movie made. Now, they've been trying to get that sequel made for many years now.
Yeah.
And now 5 years later, people are just like, you know, they're like, "Oh, really? That movie existed?" Right? Oh yeah. So speaking of not striking while the iron was hot, and this movie cost also $185 million.
Wow.
Yeah, so this movie, I mean, it did reasonable business overseas. I think it's like over $140 million worldwide. But this movie's going to have to get over $500 million before it starts to even talk about possibly making a profit on it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Was it the right time of year to release this thing?
No. I think that it almost seemed like Disney did this movie a favor by giving it any kind of, you know, outside launch anyway, because, I mean, the summer was filled. I mean, Disney has released $4 billion movies in a row. Now, obviously, all, you know, sequels and franchise movies and things like that, but, you know, you would think that this would be right in that same wheelhouse.
Yeah,
and could at least, you know, be, you know, to do, like, you know, $500 million or something. But I don't know why they chose to release it in October as opposed to maybe holding it till next summer, possibly, because it's just like, were they trying to start the holiday season early, instead of November? Yeah, and do it 2 weeks early, and they figure that, like, well, if we release it 2 weeks early, we'll announce it as an event film, and plus, it's kind of scary enough, so it'll give people, you know, families something to take their kids to on pre-Halloween weekend.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's just weird.
Yeah.
Number two, Joker, $29.2 million. It's up to almost $250 million. Man, oh man,
yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's gonna cross the $300 million in the U.S. It is this week. It's gonna pass $750 million worldwide. They're talking at least $900 million for it.
I would have never predicted that.
I thought it was gonna fall off more than it did. I'm kind of, the staying power has surprised me. I thought that the interest would be there opening weekend, and then the controversy and people having, you know, with eyes will have seen the movie and realize, well, there's nothing to this.
Yeah.
But, you know, the DC fan, hey, you know, Suicide Squad was a big hit too.
Yeah.
And I don't know anyone that likes Suicide Squad, even the people that say they liked it.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I didn't like it. I'll be honest about it. No, I didn't like I didn't like Joker either. I think Joker's one of the worst movies of the year.
Yeah.
All right, number three, Zombieland Double Tap, $26.7 million. How's that compared to the first?
It's better than the first one. First one opened at like $24 million. You take the inflation considering, it's more like $29 million. So tickets probably are down a little bit on this, but Sony will take a $26 million opening for this, especially going into the pre-Halloween weekend next week. If word of mouth is decent enough, I think that this will be a much better choice than Countdown next weekend for the Halloween crowd. So I think that, you know, but they did, the budget is a little bit higher on this one. The first one only cost $24 million. This one cost $43 million. And the first one, you know, it did $75 million in the U.S., but it only did a little over $100 million worldwide. So it's not like this was a big international hit.
Right.
This is a purely a domestic hit. I think that you can make an argument that the first one actually lost a couple bucks. But, you know, it certainly did well enough on video that, you know, 10 years later, it was like, okay, let's do it.
Yeah. All right. Adam's Family comes in at number four, $16 million, 56 total.
Yeah, this one's doing okay. It was a $40 million budget, and it looks like it's probably going to go over $80 million. That's the kind of pace it's on right now. If it gets a couple international bucks in there somewhere and gets over $100 million, it could turn a small little profit.
Okay. Wow, Gemini Man. Whoa.
Ooh, yeah.
Number five, Gemini Man, $8.5 million. It's only made $36 million. Oh, my God. I mean, this has got to be one of the biggest bombs in Will Smith's history, right?
Yeah, without question. Yeah, I mean, this thing is probably not even going to make $50 million in the U.S. It's going to make less than Ad Astra. That's the way it looks right now, because this thing fell off sharply this week. Not doing great business overseas. It even opened in China this week. You know, shout out to South Park. But this one has only done about $130-140 million worldwide so far too, and it cost $138 million. So
wow,
yeah.
Abominable, $3.5 million up to $53.9 million. That's not bad.
Yeah, it's more of a shrug than anything else. It looks like it's probably going to lose money for Universal, but you know they've had a pretty good year, so they can take this hit.
Okay, Downton Abbey still in the top 10.
Yeah. Downton Abbey, one of a couple milestones in the top 10 this week, becoming Focus Features' all-time highest domestic grossing film, passing Brokeback Mountain.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, I never expected this movie to make almost $90 million.
I don't think Focus thought that. I think Focus would have been happy with 50.
Yeah.
They probably would have been happy with 40. I don't think anyone quite saw this coming. I don't think the projections on even on opening weekend were all over the map, yeah. And I wasn't about to bet that this thing was going to do over $30 million on opening weekend.
I know it's crazy. It's crazy. Okay, and then number eight is Judy, made $2 million, $19 million total. The buzz on Renee Zellweger is going to keep this thing around for a little bit?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, it's doing pretty, I mean, it's, I think Roadside might have left a few bucks on the table by maybe not expanding this maybe a little bit earlier. But still, it's the fifth highest grossing movie in their history. It's probably, it has a chance to be the third. It's going to pass Peanut Butter Falcon, sometime this week. It has a chance of possibly outgrossing Jeff Nichols' Mud, which is the third highest grossing film in their history right now. Mm. And I think that, you know, that this has done well enough. I mean, it's, you know, $20 million that's, you know, going to gross. Doesn't sound sexy, obviously, but for a movie like this, a small budget movie, and you know, all the hype is going to be on Zellweger's performance.
Yeah,
you'll see her name cast about quite a bit by the end for the end of the year.
Oh well, there's no question about it.
Yeah,
it's that kind of performance. And mm-hmm. then, man, Hustlers,
yeah,
over $100 million. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, this is one of the success stories of the year. Over $100 million, a $20 million budget. All female cast, female director. This is quite a story. I mean, you put aside, you know, my thoughts on it. I'm not crazy about the movie,
yeah.
But financially, this is absolutely one of the really big positive stories of the year.
No question about it. All right, what are we looking for next week?
I would not be surprised if Joker retakes the top spot.
Okay,
I think that, you know, Joker, I think if anything, is probably the biggest horror movie in the lot next week, and even though it's almost a full week before Halloween, it's the weekend people are seeing movies.
Right.
And I think Maleficent could take a big hit. Joker has not been dropping huge, it could come out on top. And so probably, I don't think any of the new movies are going to bump off the top three from this week.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, that's about right. Okay, Eric, thanks, buddy.
Sure thing.
All right, we'll talk with Eric next week. And Steve, and we'll review the new movies and check out the box office as well. All right, let's take a quick break here on 720 WGN.